versus Bill Bennett.
Mr. Don Black will present argument for the petitioners.
Police Court. Your Honor, I am Don Black, representing the petitioners in this court, in this case, along with co-counsel Tammy Daniels. And for the convenience, I would like to refer to the petitioners as plaintiffs, the position they occupied in the trial court. In this case, it is a very narrow issue as a result of the of this court granting points of error number 1 through 4. And as I view that issue, the question is, can a consumer who has filed a lawsuit under the DTPA waive the protection of the DTPA by moving into the house and paying the sums that the builder requested? Very abbreviated, the facts of this case are the plaintiffs hired the defendant to build a house for them. During the course of the construction of this house, the plaintiffs observed and complained of defects and deviations from the plans and problems in the construction of that home. At a point in time, the builder advised the plaintiffs that he was through, that he had done all he was going to do, and that was it. They may as well close. They refused to close. He insisted that he was through, so they moved into the house without his permission. After they moved in the house, he suggested that they close. They went to the closing and found that he had asked for an additional $4,500 in extras that they felt was unjustified, so they refused to close. He filed a lawsuit to foreclose a lien, a mechanic's lien. He requested a temporary restraining order to enjoin them from living in the house while the lawsuit was pending. They did not want to move out of their house, so they agreed to close and to eliminate that possibility. At the closing, in addition to the approximately $4,500 in extras that they felt was unjustified, the builder requested $1,800 in attorney fees. To avoid continued litigation by the builder, they paid that. Now, they continued their lawsuit, and at the end of their case, when they rested their case after presenting their testimony, the defendant moved for an instructed verdict, and on page 5 of the opinion published by the Court of Appeals, the court recognized this as being the issue. After the Kennemores, who were the plaintiffs, rested, Bennett moved for a directed verdict urging that the Kennemores entering and taking possession of the house stopped the Kennemores as a matter of law from asserting defects or from asserting that the defects resulted in Bennett's failure to construct the house in a good and workmanlike manner. On page 8 of the opinion, the court said, applying the rules enunciated in the above cases, we conclude that the Kennemore's actions in voluntary paying Bennett are evidence of the Kennemore's acceptance of Bennett's work, that the Kennemore's are estopped to deny that Bennett did not fully comply with his contract, and that the Kennemore's waived their claim that Bennett's work was not completed according to plans and specifications.
Counsel, what sort of judgment was entered when they settled that lawsuit?
When the plaintiffs and paid,
settled Bennett's lawsuit, what sort of judgment was in it?
He simply non-suited his. There was no release, no agreement between the parties that settled anything other than he was going to discontinue any cause of action against the plaintiffs. The issue, as I see it, is that the plaintiffs, and this is something that was totally ignored by the Court of Appeals and totally ignored by the respondent in his brief to the petitioner's application for writ of error, and that is, this is a DTPA. The plaintiffs filed a lawsuit under the DTPA under 1746B5, 1746B7 and 1750A2. And the second point of error I would like to address first, the 1750A2, which is in effect the breach of the implied warranty. And I believe that the case is controlled exclusively by Melody Homes versus Barnes. When you take and when you review and examine this court's handling of the DTPA, starting out with the Melody Martin case and the Robichaud case, and then concluding with the Melody Home, I think it is clear that the state of the law in Texas is that an implied warranty that a service provider or a builder will build a house in a good and workmanlike manner is a part of the law. The DTPA demands that. The theory behind the DTPA demands it. And the court has recognized that there is the implied warranty. Now, once the implied warranty exists, and the Martin, the Melody Homes says it does exist, then the question is, can that be waived? And on page 49 of the Melody, 491 of the Melody Home case, this court says, we define good and workmanlike manner as the same manner that a person skilled in doing such work would do and in a manner generally considered skillful by those capable of judging such work. So the question that I would address first is, was there evidence that the defendant failed to build in a good and workmanlike manner the house that the plaintiff bought? Without burdening this court by reading the transcript, the statement of facts, I would call the court's attention to page 17 and 18 of my brief, where a number of problems that were existing are listed. And in the trial of the case, the defendant was asked in each and every one of these instances, is it possible to build a house? For example, is it possible to build a house so that every window does not leak? He said yes. Is it possible to build a house so that every door does not leak? He said yes. Is it possible to build a house so that the roof, the shingles on the roof do not blow off? Yes. The evidence shows that he himself acknowledged that the defects that existed in the house could be remedied and it was possible to do so. Now, on page 491 also, the court said, we overrule Dennis and hold that all service providers impliedly warrant that their services will be performed in a good and workmanlike manner. So I believe that that is settled at this time. And in my opinion, based upon the court's ruling in Melody, it's not an issue. And then on page 492 of that court...
Did you say that the Melody Homes said we overruled Dennis out?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Did you say that the opinion you read there said that Dennis Allison was overruled? I think you're reading from an earlier draft or an opinion that was withdrawn by the court.
That's a possibility, and if that is the case, I will. I apologize to the court. On 492, the court says, we further hold that the implied warranty that services will be performed in a good and workmanlike manner may not be waived or disclaimed. It would be incongruous if public policy required the creation of an implied warranty, yet allowed the warranty to be disclaimed and its protection eliminated merely by a pre-printed standard form disclaimer or an unintelligible merger clause. On page 15 of the respondent's brief, that is the only address of the DTPA issue. And he, and the respondent in his brief states that the payment of money subsequent to the recognition of the problems is a waiver, and he is a stop from continuing thereafter presenting his cause of action. The underlying basis of the DTPA is, as the court well knows, the protection of consumers. At a time in the past, the theory was caveat emptor. If you buy it, you better be careful because it's yours. But the DTPA in other cases have established that that was good for a time, but it has outlived its purpose and it is no longer the law. It's no longer the approach that we will take to the law. So therefore, once the implied warning has been established, and it has, I believe, it exists, and the issue is, what does it take to waive that? Under this case, it is my opinion that it cannot be waived. If it cannot be waived, then the plaintiffs in this case had a cause of action. They presented numerous examples of problems with the house. The court failed to respond. The trial court failed to recognize that. They he simply granted the directed verdict, and that was that. So under point of error number two, which I've addressed first, in my opinion, the evidence justified the submission of this case to the jury so that the jury could be allowed to pass on the issue of whether or not the defendant failed to construct the house in a good and workmanlike manner. Now, point of error number three and four is based upon 17, 4, 6, 5, and 7, which are representation that the services will have characteristics they do not have. On page 16 of the petitioner's brief, we set out the representations that were made. Basically, they were, he said that he would supervise his workmen. He said that he would build a house in accordance with two other houses the plaintiff looked at. The record is full of examples showing that he did not do what he said he would do. In the representations that he made, he failed to oversee the bricklayer, which resulted in the chimney being constructed improperly, the treatment above and below the windows on the outside being improper. He failed to supervise the roofer, which resulted in a defective roof being placed on the house. He failed to supervise the framer, which resulted in the omission of a door from the garage to the backyard. We have alleged under that point of error that these misrepresentations also constitute an unconscionable course of action. And the court in the Chastain versus Kuntz case, I believe, has established the standard on this issue. On page 582, the court recognizes that an unconscious act or course of action takes advantage of the lack of knowledge, ability, or capacity of a person to a grossly unfair degree. Now, on page 584 of that case, the court defines what that means. Taking advantage of a consumer's lack of knowledge to a grossly unfair degree thus requires a showing that the resulting unfairness was glaringly noticeable, flagrant, complete, and unmitigated. We have set out four examples of the defendant's actions, which in our opinion constitute actions which show that the resulting unfairness was glaringly noticeable, flagrant, complete, and unmitigated. Number one, after the contract was signed and after construction began, the defendant came to the plaintiff and said, "I would like for you to sign this mechanic's lien." The only purpose for signing this mechanic's lien, according to the defendant, was so that the defendant could go out and get interim financing. There had not been a mechanic's lien signed prior to the beginning construction on the house. Yet, at the time of the trial, the basis for the relief requested by the defendant was that this mechanic's lien contained a provision that said, entering into the possession of the house without the consent of the builder waives any complaint, waives any warranty, and simply lets the builder home free. So in my opinion, taking a mechanics lien contract that under the law would not be enforceable because it was not entered into prior to construction, and using this as a basis to defeat a complaint that they had, in my opinion, would be unconscionable because the resulting unfairness was glaringly noticeable, flagrant, complete, and unmitigated. A second act which we believe
would constitute an unconscionable course of action is that the builder was in a very unique position in that he had built the house, they had complaints, and he said to them, it's time to close. If you don't, then I'm going to sue you, and I'm going to foreclose on your house, and not only will you not have your house, you'll lose your land, which you owned in the first place. Now, the refusal of a builder who occupies that position, superior to the homeowner and the consumer, and attempting to coerce in that manner, even though he has the right to, in my opinion, the consumer does not have the full freedom to refuse to have his day in court under these circumstances. I think that is an unconscionable act. At the time that the defendant requested that the plaintiff close, he put two things in there that was not in the original contract. Number one, he asked for about $4,500 worth of extras. They said, we don't owe you, because one of the extras was the replacing of a cabinet that you broke, a marble top that you broke yourself. We shouldn't have to pay for that a second time. The other extras are not in fact extras, and we should not have to pay you. The original contract signed before construction simply said $95,000. The second contract, which was the mechanic's lien, signed after construction, is where the clause of extras was involved. For him to set a closing and say to them, the plaintiffs knowing and realizing that there was a lawsuit against them to foreclose and they had no real freedom to exercise a choice, for him to say, I'm going to close or we're going back and I'm going to foreclose on the house, and when we close, not only do I want $4,500 for extras, but I want $1,800 in attorney fees. The original contract did not make a provision for that. And the, in my opinion, unenforceable lien, which was executed subsequent to construction, is the foundation for that. Based upon all of the acts that the builder committed, and based upon the inferior bargaining position of the consumer, I believe that this is the type of case that the court would consider that the resulting unfairness is glaringly noticeable, flagrant, complete, and unmitigated. So based upon that, under Section 1746, B5, B7, and 1750, A3, we believe that the plaintiffs have established that the defendant's actions violated the deception trade practice. There were pleadings to that effect, there was evidence to that effect, and the court, in withdrawing the case from the jury and directing, instructing the verdict in favor of the defendants, was error. The final point of error is point of error number one, which the plaintiffs allege that the Court of Appeals applied the wrong standard in deciding the actions of the trial court. Page 7 of the petitioner's brief briefly states, the appellate court must view the evidence in the light most favorable to the non-movement, indulging every inference in the non-movement's favor, disregarding any conflicts in the testimony, and discarding any and all contrary evidence and inferences. If reasonable minds may differ as to the resolution of the controlling facts, jury issues exist, and an instructed verdict is improper. In other words, such a motion properly is granted only if no evidence exists upon which the jury could have made findings in favor of the non-movement. The non-movement is plaintiff. The non-movement pled the failures on the part of the defendant, proved the failures on the part of the defendant, and the Court of Appeals, in their opinion, simply based their opinion on the issue of contract law. The cases they cited to support their decision are cases primarily prior to the DTPA. They did not address the DTPA and the rights of the plaintiffs under the DTPA. It is for this reason that we feel that the Court of Appeals erred in upholding the judgment of the trial court. And for that reason, we ask this court to reverse the judgment of the trial court and amend the case for trial.
Any questions?
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We will now hear argument from this court.
May it please the court, to begin with, to answer Justice Wallace's question regarding how was the Bennett lawsuit disposed of in the district court. This case originally was filed by Mr. Bennett as a plaintiff, and at transcript page 70, the district court entered an order, in effect realigning the parties and reciting that his cause of action had been satisfied and that it would not be further urged. We are not asserting, and did not assert in the district court on motion for directed verdict, estoppel by judgment. This record does not go that far. We are not asserting estoppel by fraud, because this record does not go that far, and it was not the basis of the district court judgment. Likewise, estoppel by judgment and estoppel by fraud were not the bases for the Court of Appeals in Dallas decision in this case. The basis for the directed verdict in the district court, and more importantly, the decision of the Dallas Court of Appeals in this case, was based on estoppel principles, legal principles that I believe should be recognized and affirmed by this court. The argument that Mr. Black has made here today, and he makes a compelling argument, does not address the basis of the Court of Appeals decision with respect to estoppel. It is, in fact, a jury argument based on the facts that were presented to the district court prior to the granting of a directed verdict. The basis for the district court's grant of a directed verdict was not that there was not some evidence of the BTPA violations that had been alleged. The basis for the district court's instructed verdict, as moved for by the defendant Bennett in that context, and the basis for the Dallas Court of Appeals decision, is that notwithstanding some evidence of the violations in the BTPA, the plaintiffs were otherwise stopped by operation of law from pursuing and recovering for the defects in the home under the contract.
Counsel, I thought this court had said that common law defenses are not available in a BTPA case, and isn't that what estoppel and waiver is?
I believe that if I'm recalling the cases that Justice Spears is referring to, those cases were interpreting a provision, I believe 1742 of the DTPA, that says any waiver by a consumer is against public policy and therefore void. That provision does not apply to estoppel. It applies to waiver, and the court applied it in the cases that you had before you at that time to waiver circumstances. As Justice Maldi will tell you, when the DTPA was enacted, there were some very fine lawyers in the Texas legislature, and have been since it was enacted. The DTPA was enacted against the background of estoppel cases. The law of this state, based on estoppel and recognized in the Dallas Court of Appeals opinion, if the legislature wanted to void any estoppel defenses, in addition to voiding defenses based on waiver, which I believe that waiver provision deals with contractual waiver and not subsequent conduct, which we have in our case. But had the Texas legislature, at the time it enacted the DTPA, or during any of its subsequent legislative sessions, sought to change the law of this state regarding estoppel
by conduct
or estoppel by voluntary payment, it could have done so by enacting the appropriate provision. The cases that deal with there can be no waiver do not address
whether or not
an estoppel can still be applied to a Deceptive Trade Practices Act violation. The legislature enacted the DTPA against the background of the estoppel rules and case law of this state. Waiver is a legal term. Estoppel is a legal term. They are separate and distinct concepts which this court has repeatedly recognized.
Counsel, are you familiar with Bolton v. Alvarado? In fact, that case got down recently by this court that there are no common law defenses for DPT action, but the only defense that any case shall move to the DPA, a document of merger just brought to the DPA. Everything else, the DPA is like action. Just everything is like action, and there are no defenses other than
to the extent that the Alvarado decision made that statement, made that broad holding,
and it did not have estoppel by conduct, by subsequent conduct,
and estoppel by voluntary
payment issues before it, I would ask this court to reconsider that decision and that broad holding. You have before you now case law and a decision by the Dallas Court of Appeals asserting estoppel against the plaintiffs in this case on very compelling factual bases.
What's compelling them from their own home if they didn't go ahead and close on the deal according to the terms of the builder, whatever he wanted? What's compelling about that equity?
It was a legal dispute, Justice Spears.
I understand
that. The evidence was not put into the record. However, estoppel by conduct arises, and estoppel by voluntary payment arises to avoid injustice.
The defendant, Bennett,
took out a loan from the Mesquite Savings Loan to build this home. He built it pursuant to a contract. We believe that it was substantially completed, if not fully completed. The plaintiff then moved into the home without the knowledge and without the consent of defendant Bennett, changed all the locks on the exterior doors to completely exclude him from the premises, and then refused over several months to go to closing to make any payment against the balance of the property, and in effect to receive something for nothing. Defendant Bennett pursued his legal rights and filed a lawsuit.
I guess what I'm saying is, why not let a jury decide these questions?
Because estoppel by conduct and estoppel by voluntary payment of a disputed debt is a legal issue
for the district court to decide
and for the court of appeals to decide.
Whether or not someone is estopped is a legal issue?
If it's established as it is in this record, yes, sir. I would also urge this court to examine from a procedural perspective whether or not the plaintiffs have brought before this court the issue of whether or not the Dallas Court of Appeals judgment is in error. As Mr. Black stated, he believes that the only issue in this case is whether or not you can have a waiver under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. Waiver was not the basis of the Dallas Court of Appeals opinion. The motion for direct verdict urged an alternative basis, both waiver and estoppel, as distinct and independent legal defenses. The directed verdict was granted. The Court of Appeals opinion at page 6, and to avoid the danger of paraphrasing, and with the court's indulgence, I'll read from page 6, based this decision on estoppel by voluntary payment of a disputed debt. On page 6, the court stated, quote,
where an owner accepts the building
as completed,
enters into possession thereof,
tenders the unpaid
balance of the contract price,
asserting this is all that he owes the contractor, the owner is consequently estopped to deny that the contractor failed to comply with his contract, citing Collins versus Hall out of the Austin Court of Appeals, writ refused, WOM. The court went further and stated...
Let me stop that.
Yeah.
See, the Court of Appeals was treating the case as a breach of contract action.
I believe the Court of Appeals
dealt with it as a breach of contract and a DPPA action.
Well, where does the Court of Appeals pay attention to the Subject Trade Practices Act and the Humber Melody Homestead warrant?
It does not
directly address those issues, because I don't believe those issues were clearly raised in the appellant's brief.
And the important thing that I need to communicate to this court is that it is the plaintiff's, and in this court, the petitioner's obligation to appeal from the judgment of the Court of Appeals, and to point out to this court where that decision is in error. The basis for the Dallas Court of Appeals is based on legal estoppel. There is no assignment of error in the motion for rehearing challenging
the propriety of the legal estoppel basis of the Dallas Court of Appeals opinion. There is no point of error in the petitioner's application for writ of error challenging the propriety of the estoppel
basis
of the Dallas Court of Appeals opinion. Points 1 through 4, which this court granted the application on, certainly do not address that. Those are some evidence points, which begs the question of whether or not, when you have some evidence, can a party otherwise be estopped, as the Dallas Court of Appeals held. There is no argument and authority on the issue of estoppel. They believe this case to be one of waiver. Waiver and estoppel are different, and rightly or wrongly, whether this court has declared that all common law defenses are inapplicable in the DPPA cause of action, that issue has to be properly and procedurally brought before this court, and it has not.
Counsel, didn't your motion for an instructive verdict recite that the counterclaimants have waived and are stopped from asserting any claim against the counter-defendant for any defects and or variances to the plans and specifications of the house, or that the house was not built and didn't work in like manner?
That's exactly true, just as long as it was on an alternative basis of waiver and or estoppel. An objected verdict, just like a motion for summary judgment, the losing party must appeal on each of the alternative bases that would support the judgment.
And didn't the court's order say, without having considered the defendant's motion and argument, find that such motion should be in all things granted for the reasons set forth in the written motion?
That's exactly true, and that is the indication that the judgment...
You asked the court to direct the verdict based on waiver and estoppel.
And that is exactly my point. That judgment is supportable on the basis of waiver and or estoppel. And that was the basis for the motion, and that's the basis of the judgment in the district court. And it's the basis for the Dallas Court of Appeals opinion, though they don't discuss waivers, they ground their decision more appropriately on estoppel.
Estoppel is a lot of purpose.
Yes. I'm not arguing that the law of the state is not, as the court stated in Bolton v. Alvarado, though I ask the court to reconsider that with respect to subsequent conduct. With knowledge of rights and knowledge of defects, with legal counsel, making voluntary payments of disputed debt. However, regardless of what the law is in this state, Justice Gonzalez, a party must procedurally bring the issues on appeal before this court so that you can apply the law, and the plaintiffs in this case have not done that
with respect to
the common law defense of estoppel. And it would be inappropriate for this court to reverse the Dallas Court of Appeals decision that's grounded on the common law defense of estoppel when the estoppel issues have not been assigned as error, have not been briefed, and have not been argued in this court by the petitioner. Unless there are any questions regarding our
defense
of estoppel by conduct and by voluntary payment of a disputed debt, and more importantly, our argument that the issue of estoppel by such conduct has not been properly and procedurally brought before this court, and that you do not reach that question in this appeal. I completed my presentation this morning.
Thank you, Commissioner. Let me be very brief. It is well settled that the DPPA will be liberally construed to protect the rights of consumers.
It's very difficult to tell you. Can you answer the first of Canada? There is no more beer, no preservation of beer.
Your Honor,
the issue of stuff.
I disagree with counsel, but I
want to speak about it.
Yes, Your Honor. The judgment does, in fact, say
that if
that the defendant has waived and or, rather the motion
does
say that the plaintiffs have waived and or stopped. Now he is assuming that the court has, that the trial court acted on an estoppel. I disagree.
The court said it's fact, but just as long as you read, the court grants the motion at part of it, so it means they granted the motion and the estoppel and waived.
Yes.
I mean, I have a question. Is there any other instructions on that proper rule?
we have brought before the court the point of error that the court has erred in ruling and withdrawing from the jury the ability of this jury to rule on the BTPA violations. Now, maybe I can answer your question by looking at the Melody Home case. On page 490, the court says, when the Barnes discovered the defect in their home, they had the option to immediately sue for money damages or give Melody Home the opportunity to cure the problem. The party's choices to allow and make repairs relates back to the original purchase and were a continuation of the transactions. And then it continues, the Barnes did not lose the consumer status by allowing Melody Homes to attempt to correct the problem and by deferring their lawsuit. Under Melody Homes' argument, the Barnes would be penalized by losing their consumer status because they allowed repairs. The law encourages dispute resolution prior to its litigation. Now, this is what, in a roundabout way, the respondent is saying to this court, that by the plaintiffs, by attempting to resolve their disputes, they are stopped by their action. They are stopped from saying they have a DTPA cause of action. And that is contrary to this case where the court said, you don't lose your consumer status by attempting to resolve it. And by the same token, you cannot be stopped by attempting to resolve it short of that.
Counselor, don't you see some difference in the situation in Melody Homes in this case? For here, the plaintiff's cause of action, the consumer's cause of action, was based on the failure of the builder to comply with the contract. The lawsuit is filed, you go into court, you pay the builder everything you asked for, plus the attorney's fees. But not an attempt to take and work it out, it's laying down on his lawsuit. Now, don't you see a more than any situation as far as a stopper there? Where without paying, you've admitted everything he said is true, where the bar never admitted anything that Melody Holmes said was true.
Your Honor, the Kennemores did not make an admission that by paying the money, they did not make an admission that anything was true. I don't think the assumption can be made that the mere fact of paying money equates to an admission that they have fulfilled under the contract, because we are not going under the contract.
Well, I'm trying to get clear. The end of it. You look in court. You've got your cause of action pending, you've got his cause of action pending. Rather than go ahead and have the jury hear the case, you say, okay, Mr. Bain, here's everything you're asking for. Contract price, extra attorney's fees. So, and then you say, okay, but that doesn't count. I'm still going to contest what Mr. Bennett said when I just paid Mr. Bennett everything he asked for. Now, how does that turn around being stopped?
A person in that situation.
He has an obligation.
I have built a home. I built a $95,000 home. I'm living in that. Sure, I'm moving in chains locks because there are so many workmen who have keys we do not want. And, you know, 5 or 10 subcontractors being able to come in our house. But by me moving into my house that I'm going to have to pay, for, and then I'm going to live in, I do not want during the 2 years that a case is going to be tried
in Dallas County
to be evicted from my house and let it sit there. So I ain't going to pay. Exactly what
did
you
make the payment?
Okay, pardon?
When did you make the payment?
The payment was made shortly before the TRO hearing. And I think about 2 or 3 weeks after the lawsuit was filed, somewhere in that time frame.
But
there had been any paid under protest or trying to tender it into court?
No.
And if I'm wondering, as the judge did not rely on the party until page 70 or get drop and still?
I cannot address that, Your Honor. I'm not sure at what point they did.
It was a trial or during trial, though.
I think parties were realigned. I do not know if it was before or during, but the parties
recognized in the beginning this is a proper plan.
It was. When was the first time that this estoppel or waiver argument was raised? It was raised in the plea, I think, with the trial plea by the defendant.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I cannot answer that.
Well,
any summary judgment.
You know if there were any summary judgment?
That was never known.
But to answer your question, let's assume that a person buys the house,
pay for it,
and moves in the house, and then discovers a defect. By the fact that he's already paid, are we going to make it a subjective test that the
that a person who sits under the DTPA can only
recover a
defect that arose after he moved into the house? Most of the defects are not discoverable until after payment is made. But to me, a distinction point, and whether or not it's a dispositive point, I don't know. The distinguishing point here is that the federal lines were drawn, the issues were closed. You were saying leaky doors, leaky roofs, leaky windows, no door, that door on the garage. He's saying everything down according to the contract.
You read the order
where people take the disputes, or they have disputes, and can't tell them otherwise. And you say, okay, I'm going to pay you anything they're asking for.
Now,
but it's a situation, a tax situation,
we have not paid before under the EPA when it comes down to
common law defenses. I will agree that what you thought
is correct,
that when you address that to the contract, the builder says we have done everything
we're going to do under the contract. The home buyer, the consumer, says, I understand you said that, but I still have a complaint.
And my complaint is not
under the contract, although he sued alternatively,
my complaint is not pursuant to the contract.
My complaint is pursuant to the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, where you have breached the implied warranty. You have committed an unconscionable action, a course of action. You have represented to me that you were going to do things,
and you did not do them.
And based upon
the melody home.
He has that right.
No theory where
it says that they should try to work out his problems.
And that they do not waive
consumer status
by doing so.
The same?
Well, I don't think they do not.
I don't think anybody's arguing.
You're a consumer, isn't it?
I don't think you find any argument.
I would need
to defend it. You were consumer.
But the
that's what we were addressing.
Melody home part you had.
I think it's analogous, though, that if a person,
in this case, they said
you waive your consumer status
by your actions.
In other words, you are stopped because of your actions.
Seem to allege that you're a consumer.
The case, the court there said, no, he is not a stop because of his actions.
For being a consumer, I think the same logic would say that he is not a stop from presenting
his complaint
under any EPA
by his actions.
And
you say that you preserved your error on that issue and helped the court appeal from here.
I think
want to recover any possible way the trial court moved. I think it's true enough.
I don't think it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Well, that makes a brief recess.
All right.